in many of Master's poems and Whispers from Eternity. He'll use the image of flowers as the form behind which God's presence is revealed. It's a very sweet habit that he does that. Flowers are so innocent and so ubiquitous. And even though, of course, we cultivate them and try to make them more and more beautiful, nonetheless, we don't create them. They simply exist and we can cooperate with them. Looking at these pink roses on the altar today, Master said that roses have a particularly high vibration. That's why when we do Kriya initiations, you're handed rose petals when you're initiated, and then afterwards the Kriya acharyas will sprinkle rose petals over everyone. In our wedding ceremony, we bless you with rose petals. And just looking into the heart of these pink roses, there's such an intensity of life and color, and to no purpose whatsoever, really, except just to give beauty, to serve beautifully. In our community, there's quite a few rose gardens, thanks in no small measure to Pam Peterson, who puts a lot of energy into them. And right by the front entrance, there's some particularly tall rose bushes. And I remember one year, after all the other roses had bloomed, at the very top of one of those rose bushes, it was 7 feet in the air, there was one huge red flower. And it stood there for a really long time, just like a sentinel flower. It was almost like it was some kind of a prima donna that simply refused to shine when the others were there. Or else it was a selfless sacrifice on its part, that it would appear alone. After all the other flowers had gone, then it would present itself to, you know, to give us some reminder still. Now, to a certain extent, thoughts like these are merely fanciful. They're beautiful, poetic images. But the fact that Master uses them so much tells us that there's much more behind it. Because in the life of a master, nothing is accidental. Master made a much more important statement when he said simply, he said, no one crossed his path. Not one person came before his eyes ever, anywhere, unless there was some divine intention behind it, that on some level of their being they needed to be touched. A master used to go down to the Bowery District in Los Angeles, a place where people were far from, for the most part, far from being ready for what he actually had to teach, and he didn't teach. Apparently he just walked up and down the streets, just finding people who were in the throes of misery and just with a little bit of his consciousness, planting some deep seed within them that who knows how many incarnations it would take before it sprouted. I've always been touched by something that's in the Edgar Cayce readings, where many people who would go to him, he was a sleeping psychic from some decades ago, and he would often describe what was happening in a person's present incarnation in terms of something they were working with because they had lived at the time of Christ. And it wasn't, as you know, psychics who flatter the ego always tell you that you were somebody very, very important. How many people were Marie Antoinette? How many could have been Marie Antoinette or Mary Magdalene or whatever? Edgar Cayce was more realistic. He would say, you were standing on the street and Christ walked by. And perhaps that was the whole relationship that you had, and yet 2,000 years later was still the operative power in the life of many people. They were still trying to rise up to the potential that was planted in them by that contact. And we're about to take a pilgrimage to India with 31 people from some, about half from this community and from other Ananda communities. And that experience of going to India on pilgrimage, this is the 12th time or the 11th time we've taken a group. And there's a reality to it that we've come to describe in this way. It's when you read in a negative sense about the effect of radioactive materials and how it radiates this force that for a long time causes genetic mutation or whatever it is that the organism shifts. These spiritual experiences we have, this pilgrimage to India, one moment in the company of a saint, there's an Indian proverb that says, one moment, actually it's a line from a song, one moment in the company of a saint will be your raft over the ocean of delusion. It's very hard to put that in proportion because we think in material terms. We think in terms of weight and mass and time, and how could just one moment in the company of a holy person, how could just standing on the road when Christ walked by become the operative force? Well, speaking of the radioactive image, it's like a little bit of something gets planted inside of us. And even though we may have forgotten it's there, it's still radiating with this force. And that force is mutating our whole form of consciousness much more profoundly. The things that we think are important in our lives, the things that we in human terms, in worldly terms, judge as being the significant events. So often people tell us when they transcend this world in what now people call near-death experiences, because it's a real death, but it's a death in return. One suddenly realizes that all that one was devoting all one's energy to, which is building castles on the sands of materiality, which will just dissipate and turn into nothing in the end anyway, all of that was just not wasted effort, because it's like training at the gym. You build certain willpower muscles and certain determination muscles that will serve you at the time when you finally have your objectives more valid. But the only thing that really matters is what kind of consciousness we expressed. And this statement that's in the Bible that's so often used to abuse other religions, ah, what travesties are done in the name of God. God must either weep or laugh. The way people respond to this, Master was fond of telling a joke about a very famous evangelist of his, a contemporary of his. There was a man named Billy Sunday who used to have these tent revivals and hundreds of people, thousands of people. He would call out to them in his that emotional way that those evangelicals can do, and they would all give up their sins and they would come to the altar and he would bless them and then he would declare them saved. And this joke goes that when Billy Sunday got to heaven and he wanted to get in, St. Peter checked the rolls and he couldn't find his name there at all. And Billy Sunday was quite outraged. He said, "I've sent thousands of people to heaven." And St. Peter said wryly, "Well, perhaps you sent them, but they never arrived." The rest of that joke, the similar joke, is the one about the New York City cab driver who actually got right into heaven ahead of lots of preachers, and the preachers couldn't understand why. And then St. Peter explained, "Well, the way he drove lots of people to religion." There was more sincere praying in the back seat of his cab than there was in many a church. So there's many different ways that God works. But in this scripture today, Master quotes that, Swami quotes that line, "All those who came before me were thieves and robbers." And of course, any intellectual definition of that, when there's a predisposition of the heart to want to prove this strange singular superiority of Jesus, one reads that to mean that everything that came before him was everyone was a false prophet. And reason follows feeling. Once the heart is made up, it's just astonishing how we can rationalize what we want to believe. This is the enormous danger of reason as opposed to intuition. Intuition knows the truth directly. Reason just comes at it indirectly and just goes in wild circles. And all of that confusion emanates not really from the mind, but it emanates from the feelings, which is centered in the heart. Which is a very interesting aspect of spiritual life, that, especially in terms of meditation, that we need to remember. Swamiji made the very telling comment. He said, people talk, when they talk about meditating, about calming the mind. He said, but it's not really the mind that has to be calmed, it's the heart that has to be calmed. Because it's the restless longings of the heart that disturb the mind. If you think about it, when you're meditating and your mind starts going somewhere, why does it go that way? Where? Because there's a feeling that wants to go that way. That where? go there, I guess is what I'm trying to say. But there's just some hunger, I mean literal hunger for food, a hunger for revenge, a hunger for self-justification, a fear that such and such a task won't be done and the mind starts spinning on it, a fear that a disappointment will not be alleviated by fulfillment. Every restless thought has its origin point in some lack of rest in the heart. And that's why Master said, devotion is half, chanting, he said, is half the battle of the spiritual life. Because chanting awakens the natural devotion of the heart. When we're listening to beautiful music like Bhagavati and Ramesha were playing for us today, or the beautiful chanting that Joe was doing before and during service, and we just hear that longing, it touches something in us that drives away all the other desires that we have. Swamiji's music, all of these 400 pieces of music that he's written, they're very interesting because it's a peculiar kind of music. Peculiar, the right word I mean is unique. A particular kind of music that doesn't exist really or exists only occasionally from other composers. It's Swamiji's unique contribution, is opening up a channel of a different kind of music. Master said that music is for, the purpose of music is divine realization, not entertainment. That doesn't mean that we haven't been entertained by a lot of music, but he's talking about why God made music. Because music, because we, this whole creation, is vibration. We are one with the Om vibration. We are a manifestation of the Holy Spirit, which is the power of spirit vibrating as the Om sound. And so when we hear music especially, it's not a secondary experience. When you look at beautiful art, you see it with your eyes and it comes in and we are inspired by it or hear words, but they have to go through the filter of what do those words mean. But when we hear music, it's a vibration itself and it goes right into the core of our being. And the quality of Swamiji's music is very interesting because it has deep feeling, but it doesn't have emotion. Now, to distinguish those two points is very important, and it's sort of arbitrary in English because we don't have any other way of describing it, but this is how we mean it. When true feeling takes us deeper into our own nature, it expands our sense of ourselves and centers us deeply in the truth of who we are. It calms the heart. Emotion is feeling that moves us a little off center. You know, a great deal of romantic music just fills you with this longing. You know, where and when will my soulmate come? And or why am I not fulfilled in the relationship I have? Or the longing for children or whatever it might be. Not that those desires are necessarily wrong, because each of us has our own karma that we have to fulfill. Through those human experiences, we can come deeper into the heart of feeling, which calms the heart and makes us more of what we really are, instead of making us long for something outside of ourselves. This is the desire that comes through the senses and the mind and the intellect. The senses give us the information, the mind receives it, then the intellect defines it. That's again, these are English words. There's true Sanskrit words for this, which I don't know, which define all those aspects of us. But Swamiji's music just centers you deeply, us deeply in who we are. And not everyone likes it. Swamiji, when he was in Italy, there was a man who was starting a business, a little coffee shop, and Swamiji wanted to help him, and he took a CD of his music to this man. This is sort of like just walking down the street. I mean, this man was not ready for it, but Swami gave it to him and said, maybe if you played this, make your customers happy being in here. Well, the man played it when Swami came in, but I don't think he played it any other time at all. And Swamiji remarked afterwards, quite simply, said he's simply too restless for my music. When that music would try to push him to a place of calmness within, there was just too much agitation. It would, not only could he not go there, he would actively not want to go there. Because to him, it would feel like the loss of everything that he was. I mean, that his vibration was this, and you try to take that away from him, and he wonders what's going to be left, because there's no inner experience. But for those of us who devote our lives to deepening our inner experience, then oftentimes Swamiji's melodies just pierce right into the doorway that we've been working so hard to open and settle us so deeply. Master's chants, chanting is half the battle, because you sing those chants and all of a sudden we know who we are and we're at peace with that. Over the years, it's just become more and more obvious to me that the spiritual path is a very simple battle between the thought that we won't be fulfilled unless we have these certain things and the fear that all those desires generate, and the calm confidence of simply knowing that God is in charge, that truth has its own power, that we don't need to be anxious. Really, we don't need to be anxious about anything. That's the hardest thing to grasp. And the more boldly we put it that way, and coming back to our scripture reading, when Jesus made that statement, all who came before me are thieves and robbers, he wasn't talking about other spiritual teachers, because in many other places in the Bible, those who are not, you know, against us are with us. He says so many different things that are non-sectarian that prove the folly of that statement. But what he meant was anything that becomes between you and your divine nature is the thief of your happiness. That's all. We think it's going to give us happiness, but it's the thief of our happiness. Anything that comes between us and the understanding of our Christ consciousness will, to that extent, permeate us with fear and anxiety. I mean, what is the definition of hell? Fear and anxiety. You can be anywhere if you're fearless, if you're not anxious about it. What is there to trouble you? I mean, we have all these natural fears of pain and loss, and there's just so much emphasis given on the importance of experiencing your pain and your loss. Yes, awareness is necessary. People have to understand that to be unaware is not the same as to transcend. To transcend is to know exactly what it is, to know exactly what karmic difficulties one has had to face, what one has been born with. Our life experiences are there to teach us, to show us our own attitudes. I've so often seen in my own life and in the lives of others this peculiarity of how sometimes one seems to be born into karmic conditions that just take your faults and make them worse. It's just amazing to me. I just can't believe when I look over my childhood, everything that was wrong with me, you know, that I've come to see as the delusions that hold me back the most, were virtually encouraged in my family. It was just like every fault that I had was exaggerated because of where I was born. And I think, Lord, why didn't you give me some kind of a counterweight? Wouldn't it have been a good idea to train me in the opposite of the direction I was already going? But then I realized, of course, and this is what I've seen, that I liked those delusions. I wanted those delusions. And it was necessary to keep pushing me in the direction I was going until I saw that they were not my friends, that in fact they were thieves and robbers, that they were taking me away from what I really wanted. You see, then comes the calmness of the heart. And the path that we walk is a complicated one in this simple way. We have to affirm right attitudes. We have to discipline our nature to behave in the right way. I've always been so impressed with Haridas, who many of you know. He lived here for a few years. It was our great good fortune to have him and Roma, his wife, living here with us. But Haridas has always been extremely conscientiously positive in the way he responds to what happens to him. And I mean, I would almost say to a ludicrous degree. But it's not ludicrous at all, because he's had this quality that I admire so much. He's one of the, he's notable in this respect. He rarely, and I would dare say never, loses track of what he's really doing here. So many of us justify, oh, well, I have to be practical. Oh, well, I have to prepare for my retirement. Oh, I have to also stand up for myself or this or that. It's not simple. Because it's not like there's one code of behavior that really is the right code of behavior. It's not as if being nice is really the goal of the spiritual path. You know, many very saintly people are not nice at all in the conventional sense. They don't bother with being polite or careful or anything like that. Even Swamiji has had to say in the last few years, He said, I used to be much more careful of people's feelings. He said, I could just say a little of what I felt they needed to know. And then he said, literally, then I would wait 10 years and just sort of let them work with that and then perhaps suggest something else. But he said, I don't have that much time anymore. And he was, in a sense, apologizing to a man whom Swamiji had scolded very strongly in front of others. He said, I hope it didn't hurt your feelings. He said, but I don't have much time left, and I want to help you as much as I can. I mean, they're just not always considerate because it's not always the primary value. And often for us, the intention of being nice and never really offending anyone and never really taking a strong position and always thinking of the other person's point of view is sometimes just a mask for fear. Often it's not really an honest statement even of what we ourselves feel. It's just a desire not to want to rock the boat. And what we're really acting on is fear. God watches the heart. He doesn't listen to our words, thank God, because we often don't even know what we're talking about. In autobiography of, I hope the present ince doesn't apply, but in Autobiography of a Yogi, there's just such a touching statement from Sri Yukteswar when he's talking to Master about how he's going to train him. He said, you have to learn to listen to the meaning behind what people say. They often don't say what they mean. They often don't even know what they mean. They just have feelings and then they attach words to them. One of my dear friends for many years at Ananda Village, she was so random in her speech, literally, she used to often say the opposite of what she meant. But I just knew her and I would just hear the words and it would give me sort of a clue as to what the subject was. And then I just began to understand what she actually meant. I mean, she just didn't like words very much. She just preferred intuition. So she used them randomly. Some of us may think we're using them accurately, but how often does somebody just tell you something really emphatically and you know for a fact it's not at all what they mean? They just either aren't thinking clearly or they don't know what they mean. God listens to the heart. He listens to who we really are. And how we behave is sometimes conditioned by all sorts of things that is not really us. But we have to try our best to use our energy in a way that's consistent with the calm understanding that we are really children of God. And at the same time, we mustn't be fooled by our own affirmations. Over the years, I've had several instances of experiences with Swamiji where I've been so impressed to realize that what I think of as the expression of right attitude is not an attitude at all. It's simply the way the world looks to him. An example I've often shared with you is my realization after many years of how respectful Swamiji had always been of the fact that even though I was more than 20 years younger than him and utterly inexperienced, that never stopped me from being absolutely certain of my opinions. And it never stopped me from, as he put it me years later, thwarting his intentions with my ignorance. And out of respect for me, you often thwarted me, was his words. But out of respect for me, he would just let it ride, not just for me, but for everyone. And as I grew older and began to work with many people, I realized how complex it can be. And I thanked him for the way he treated me. I said, I really appreciate the fact that you never, and I mean this, he never made reference to my age or experience or lack of it, ever. And God knows I sorely tried him, and it would have been the most natural thing to say, which is something on the level of, you twerp, what are you talking about? You know, but never. And when I thanked him for that, his answer was, when I mentioned age, he said, I never noticed. Just like that. It wasn't like he tried to be respectful. He never thought of me or anyone. He said, I never think of anyone in terms of their age. He said, not even children. I just see them as they are and then relate appropriately to what I see in front of me. Swamiji once made the comment, he said, everyone looks the same to me. He said, it's all just egos trying to become free. And then he even added the interesting comment, even animals. He said, it's all just a spectrum. Animals are just bound by a much less conscious ego, as we said in our scripture reading. They don't have the self-consciousness to deliberately engage in their evolution. That's the difference between animals and humans. They don't have an ego. So they can't say, oh, I am suffering for this reason, and therefore I will be different. They don't have the thief and robber. They haven't transcended it. They haven't even become aware of it. It's a very good example of the difference. Animals can't think abstractly. Oh, last week, as I recall, I saw the dog across the street run into the street and got hit by a car. So perhaps, you know, and they can't reason like that. They can't think about dogs in Africa who are hungry. You know, they don't have that. Whereas the human being, the ego self, can reflect on all these realities and learn in that way. But it's just the soul identified with something it is not. It's the soul giving in to that thief who's stealing our happiness. Every single moment of less than perfect bliss that we experience is caused by exactly the same thing. It's because somehow the restlessness of the heart has told us that what's happening now is outside of God's plan, and in this instance, I have to grab and hold for myself. I have to be afraid that things won't come out right. I have to think that this didn't happen as it was meant to happen. It's just all these different realities. It's such an extraordinary experience and a wonderful practice in meditation to just sink totally comfortably into the moment that we're in and realize that nothing else is required. And then watch all the little restlessnesses of the heart that try to tell us that something else is required, you know? But it's not. That's where chanting and japa and devotion simply save us. When we are in the presence of the Master, when we are in the presence of the light, where would we go? What would we want? Everything just proves transparently unnecessary compared to that bliss. Let us live in that truth.